You're listening to episode 18 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in snowy Philadelphia.
David, we're happy to have a guest with us this episode. He's Bob Schmidt, president of UAV Propulsion Tech. Bob has a U.S. tech representative business which markets propulsion, servo, rescue, and recovery parachutes to the U.S. UAV industry. Bob, welcome to the UAV Digest.
Thanks, Max and David. Great to be here.
Now, the products you market come from companies based primarily in Germany and Australia.
That's correct. Yeah. Orbital is based in Perth, Australia. They have unique heavy fuel engine technology. Hearth Motors, I guess from your airplane experience, you're probably familiar with that company. They're a sport aviation engine manufacturer outside of Stuttgart, Germany.
Yes.
And then Vols Servos, also in Germany in the Frankfurt area. Just recently, within the last year, started working with Sky Graphics. They're actually a paraglider parachute company that also are in the rescue recovery chute market. And they had some relationships or experience with some of the Hearth guys. And so they kind of linked me up. They were looking for somebody in the U.S. to try to go after the rescue recovery market here. And so I guess in the last year, I've just started picking up that product line.
Fantastic. That's great. All right, David, what news stories do we have this week?
Well, our first one is we go to Mexico and a mayor wants to buy drones for his town. Then we'll move a little up north to Area 51, and Aviation Week in Space Technology released the story of the RQ-180, the replacement of the RQ-170 that we lost in Iran. Then we'll go a little bit, we'll dive down under, this time water, and the Navy sub-launched a drone. And last but not least, drones that heal themselves. That'll be interesting. But most of all, we'll be focusing on our guest, Bob. A trip down to Mexico. Tijuana wants to buy 3D robotics RTF quadcopter drones to monitor traffic, evaluate accident scenes, detect landslides, and control wildfires. Sounds like a initial investment, Mexico being far more proactive, evidently, than here in the United States.
Yes, we do have some limitations as we await the regulations from the FAA. But yeah, Tijuana is, I guess, the second city in Mexico to look to UAVs to try to perform these functions. They are less expensive than other methods for doing this. And they sound like the kinds of applications that most any city would be interested in.
Yeah, I guess it's a tough one. I mean, there's a lot of applications, as we've seen recently, where it would make sense to put a drone up in the air. But, you know, there's a lot of concern over the other aircraft that may be flying around and could be put in danger, I guess.
Yeah, good point, Bob. And, you know, while we do complain about the FAA's conservatism in the United States, that opinion may change if other places around the world who are not kind of operating under that conservatism run into those kind of problems and actually have some accidents or some incidents like that. I also wonder about the use. While the applications that are in this article, as I say, make sense for a city, I also wonder to what extent these things could be used for other purposes, more surveillance and other things that may raise privacy concerns. You know, maybe in some areas of the world, the local government may be more prone to using drones in whatever way they feel like using them for their own purposes. So that could become an issue.
No, I don't know. But anybody who's been in Tijuana with traffic, having a drone to be able to monitor it, but it's a giant border crossing, so it'll be interesting to see how the U.S. Tijuana is bumped up right against basically the suburbs of San Diego. So it'll be interesting to see what happens if a drone crosses the border accidentally. Then we have a drone incursion, you know, or suddenly the U.S. drones and the Mexican drones are playing chicken with each other. So this is going to be interesting. While it's only a mayor of the town operating it, there are international consequences involved. So I think we'll have to keep an eye on this one.
All right, next up we have an article from Aviation Week. Aviation Week seems to be bringing us a number of sort of exclusive stories. This is one on a secret new UAS that's also very stealthy. In fact, it graces the cover of the current issue of Aviation Week.
Yep, Aviation Leak did it again. Bill Sweetman et al. Had released the RQ-180, which is the replacement to the RQ-170, which in drone parlance and drone history has gone down to be legendary as the Iranians. It's the super stealth drone, the Beast of Kandahar that got shot down over Iran. And supposedly in the next week or so, the Iranian copy will be flying. And all the while, the Pentagon and the Air Force and everybody was sort of like, okay, they got it. Okay, no big deal. Well, evidently, we had already moved on to the RQ-180, which is surprisingly larger, built by Northrop. And it's got 130-foot wingspan and the ability, though speculative, to be able to not only fly above weapons and to avoid radars and jamming and stuff, but also to carry weapons and drop its own bomb. So this is the next step. You know, we're always like one step ahead of everybody else in the black world and Area 51. And this is the next step in drones or UAVs for the Air Force.
Now, I think the Aviation Week article is interesting in that it speaks to some of the clues that have been out there that there was some activity going on in this arena. You know, this is a secret or has been a secret program. They note that as far back as 2008, there was a large increase, a $2 billion increase in Northrop Grumman's Integrated Systems Division, which is the division that produces these sorts of things. And also there are clues like financial reports acknowledging some kind of an unmanned aircraft program, other publicly available photos of Area 51 showing some new hangars and things like that. But, you know, it's interesting to think about how these programs come about in secret. You know, Bob, one of the things that we were wondering about, and maybe you have some insight on this, is to what degree do programs like this build everything from scratch as opposed to using commercially available or off-the-shelf components like propulsion systems and that sort of thing?
Yeah, I guess in my experience, both on the Earth and orbital side and on the propulsion side of things, a lot of them try to use as much off-the-shelf propulsion that they can, but typically the airframe is unique to their application. You know, some of the bigger guys, of course, will try to adapt a customized propulsion system around their application. The challenge is a lot of the small UAS guys, you know, just don't have the budgets and they, you know, get stuck with using RC engines and then, you know, have reliability issues because they weren't really meant to fly at altitude or for anything greater than, you know, say 50 hours. So, yeah, that's the challenge. I think the ones that are successful are the ones that are actually developing custom propulsion systems for their application or the ones that are using aviation-type engines like your the Rotex or the gas turbine-type engines that are aircraft-certified.
Right. Well, the types of propulsion systems that you market, what are the applications where those are typically used?
On the orbital side, we've developed a heavy fuel engine for the Aerosonde UAV. We also just got a new contract this summer. A customer has not been identified yet or doesn't want to go public yet, but hopefully soon. But it's a large U.S. SUS manufacturer, and it'll be a clean sheet heavy fuel engine integration program. On the Hearth side, they do UAV engines for a number of companies. In the U.S., they have the BAT, Northrop BAT UAV, the flying wing.
Oh, yes.
In Europe, they do the Skeldar from Saab, the Cybero VTOL, which is linked here in the U.S. with AeroVironment to try to get the U.S. market. Rheinmetall, KZO, EMT Luna, Denel Seeker 2, what else they have? A number of applications. Those are the ones that are in the public domain, but some companies just use off-the-shelf engines too. Some of the Hertz stuff, you know, they do have a family of off-the-shelf engines that someone can get started with, and then they also have UAV variants that have more advanced EFI systems with EMI and EMC shielding and more data link back to the flight control so they can monitor engine health and, you know, fuel consumption and things like that. So, yeah, their UAV engines are actually more advanced than their sport aviation engines.
Hey, Bob, I guess for some of our other listeners, define what a heavy fuel engine is.
Yeah, heavy fuel. NATO and, of course, the U.S. have this one fuel policy where they're trying to eliminate gasoline for safety and logistics reasons. It's a real issue on Navy ships. They don't want to have gasoline on Navy ships. So if they're flying UAVs, you know, if they're using anything with a piston engine that typically burns gasoline, it's a safety risk. And in theater, it's also could be a factor of getting the fuel and being able to, you know, they want to be able to use fuel out of a Humvee, you know, JP-8 kind of stuff. But it's basically kerosene-type jet fuel that's typically either burned in a gas turbine or in a compression ignition engine. So what we've done, and I guess some other people are trying to do too, but on how we've solved the problem is we use the Orbital air-assisted direct injection system. So it's it uses compressed air to atomize the fuel. It's been in production since 96 on a lot of consumer applications like Mercury Optimax outboards and Aprilia Piaggio scooters and lots of two-stroke applications to meet emission requirements. And we found that we can get very fine atomization with it, so we can actually spark ignite kerosene. So you can burn kerosene in just a standard two-stroke, but typically you have to heat it in order for it to run, and then the combustion process is typically unstable. So if you can direct inject it and get good atomization, you can get more reliable combustion, and you don't need heaters when you cold start.
What are the power ratings of the engines that you market?
I'd say in the 3 horsepower to 100 horsepower.
Okay.
So down from the Predator kind of thing. You know, Predators are, you know, 914 Rotexes and up, you know, gas turbines and things.
Yeah.
We're more SUAS and larger. I think the largest Hertz is probably the Denel Seeker 2. That's probably that's a 50 horse air cooled boxer engine. But they, you know, they also have 3-cylinder, 85 horsepower water cooled two-stroke engines too. So the focus on the Orbital side is typically SUAS, I'd say less than 20 horsepower, and the Hertz is probably more in the 15 to 100 horsepower depending on the requirements.
And how's the market unfolding for you? Are you seeing changes in the level of interest in building these systems?
Yeah, it's interesting though. It's the larger companies, the ones that have money to invest in their own custom engines, are also the ones that are producing more. There are a lot of UAV companies out there, and I think it's going to be similar to the auto business back in the, you know, early 1900s and beer companies, you know, where there were thousands of them, and then, you know, people get bought up, you know, and since you got bought by Boeing and Northrop's using the Swift UAV. You know, there's a lot of partnering and purchasing going on for consolidation. So, yeah, I think the market for a COTS or consumer off-the-shelf engine can be a challenge. You know, everybody wants a, say, 3-horsepower, 4-horsepower engine that can run on heavy fuel. But most of our stuff in that size is not off the shelf. We're typically doing custom applications for our customers.
And the manufacturers are willing and eager to do customized applications?
I think if they are a larger company, then they see they see a competitive advantage in the technology, then they're willing to do it. The big thing is reliability these days. You know, the payloads are very expensive. A lot of these programs now, they're not selling assets, they're selling camera time. So reliability and uptime, cost per hour is a driver. So yeah, we've been very busy actually. I think I'd say probably 4 or 5 years ago, it kind of slowed down a little bit. We had like a a spike probably 05, 06, and then it slowed down a little bit. But in the last, I'd say, 3 or 4 years, we've been very busy trying to support a lot of applications.
Great.
The challenge is, though, is you just never know how many of these guys are going to produce. You know, somebody could only be producing 20 a year, and somebody else could be doing 500 a year, you know?
Yeah.
So that's the challenge.
And I imagine there are a certain number of people out there who are producing great ideas for applications, but never produce an aircraft.
Yeah, that's true. And I guess you can, yeah, you always test that when you tell them how much an engine is.
Yeah.
So, Bob, I guess our next topic, the U.S. Navy fired the XFC drone from an underwater submarine, was an all-electric fuel cell-powered unmanned system that was sub-launched out of a Tomahawk cruise missile bay and rocket-launched up to the water and then flown on. So do you see any prospects in the electric industry, since the Navy's clearly wants some sort of alternative fuel besides the heavy fuel, like fuel cells or electric?
Yeah, I saw that, and I thought it was very interesting. Yeah, I guess here in the States, AeroVironment's probably the biggest electric guy that has a majority of the business for, you know, your Pumas and Ravens. But you have limited endurance on them, and, you know, they are doing things to those applications, whether it's adding a fuel cell or, you know, optimizing motors and batteries to increase that. But we've also looked at hybrid systems and what can be done from a piston engine standpoint to generate electricity for some of these smaller applications that are using electric motors.
Yeah, and fuel cells. I mean, I'm not a fuel cell expert by any means, but I don't think we don't make fuel cells that are really small and tiny and applicable for a lightweight vehicle, do we?
Yeah, I wouldn't think so. I had some experience with fuel cells in, when I was an employee for Orbital. We did a lot of automotive work, and we were looking at applying our injection system on automotive fuel cells and things. And I know that market had a lot of challenges just in the environment and where those things were operating. So, you know, the environment of a UAV is pretty aggressive. So, you know, it may be applicable, but, you know, maybe limiting the environments they can fly in. Hmm.
David, were you expecting the Navy to launch something like this? This kind of came to me sort of out of the blue. Did we seen any history on the development of this kind of thing?
Oh, the Navy will shoot anything out of a torpedo tube.
Right, just because they can, huh?
Just because they can. They've done it with SEALs. They've done it with midget subs. They've done it with Tomahawk missiles, ballistic missiles. It was only natural. I mean, they have flown airplanes off of subs. There is sort of a connection. Early in the 50s, there were large aircraft-sized cruise missiles that they would launch from submarines, but they'd have to surface. There's a submarine, and I don't remember the name of it off the top of my head, that's parked next to the Intrepid that actually has its missile and its hangar bay. So the Navy always wants to use subs. It's the quietest, sneakiest, stealthiest way to get close to the shore. That's why we have now subs that are designed to transport SEALs, you know, and if you can quietly launch a drone to do observation from a sub that's sitting offshore that nobody knows is there, that's really good technology. And as the drone technology is a new part, the getting it to the surface via a launch tube or a vertical tube, that's a piece of cake for technology for the Navy. They've been doing that for years. So, I mean, the Tomahawk land attack missile, they've got that, and basically that was the technology. The booster rocket for that was what was used for the XFC. So this is just one more step of the technology, and of course the Navy wants to shoot them out of subs. It makes perfect sense to them.
All right. Well, our next item is kind of interesting to me because this topic has come up frequently about drone safety and what happens when you have a failure, and because many of these things are not aerodynamically stable.
Are you hinting that you're having trouble with your new endeavor?
Well, actually, I haven't been able to. The weather has precluded me from conducting any more flights of my little quadcopter. But yeah, in fact, actually, that this is going to lead to a good conversation with Bob, because well, first from this article in Fast Company, the idea here is that can you add intelligence to the onboard control system so that if there is a rotor failure or a breakage or, you know, it hits something, that it doesn't behave like a rock and just drops straight to the ground? Can the thing recover? And what we see here is a video demonstrating the use of an intelligent controller. So in this video, actually, they start with a vibrating propeller that eventually breaks off or comes off a quadcopter. And there are sort of two versions of this. One is without the adaptive software, and it just falls, crashes to the ground. And in the other, with the adaptive software, it initially starts to kind of tumble, but then it detects that it's become unstable, and it reacts to that, adapts to that, becomes, I would say, partially stable, and then lands itself quickly, which is, that's interesting. That sounds like an important thing to be able to build into systems like this.
Yeah, I think especially, too, for these quadcopters or hexacopters or whatever you call them with multi-blades, because most of those are going to be flying relatively low altitude and probably mostly around people, you know, crowds, right, or events or that type. And we've already seen in the press some incidents where they've fallen out of the sky and hit somebody. So, yeah, it's interesting. I saw that article, too, how it did kind of auto-correct a little bit, and they were able to kind of recover it. So it was, I think it's a good idea.
Now, the link back to what you do, Bob, is that as I was trying to fly my little quadcopter, as David suggested, you know, I started thinking about things like the Cirrus aircraft. Those have ballistic recovery parachutes. And I found myself wondering, wow, you know, with some of these quadcopters, even the small ones that, like you say, have camera equipment on there, they can be pretty expensive, and the camera equipment mm-hmm. can be very expensive. So some kind of parachute recovery or safety system kind of sounds like an appealing idea. So what can you tell us about the systems that that do that you're familiar with?
Yeah, we haven't really been looking at them for that size of aircraft, and maybe we should. The smallest application that we're developing right now is I'd say 44-pound, you know, 20-kilogram mm-hmm. kind of application. And I guess there's two different ways you can use it. I mean, most of these small UAVs, you know, the fixed-wing UAVs, either, you know, the electric ones can land, skid on the ground. You've got some of the larger ones come into a net, or, you know, Scan Eagle comes into a skyhook. There's some kind of recovery method. And some of the European UAVs actually use a parachute for recovery. EMT Luna uses a parachute recovery. Rheinmetall on their KZO, they do parachute recovery. So you're basically not dependent upon some kind of recovery system. But then you're also dependent upon the wind and everything else. But yeah, we've been looking at these systems. I think in the U.S., the market's probably more on the rescue side than the recovery side. Or so that, you know, if for some reason you have an engine out or a system failure where you can't bring it back to base or bring it home safely, you can deploy a chute and it's going to bring it down safely and protect, you know, payload and potentially even property or people that it may come in contact with. Yeah, I guess what this thing does is you typically have some kind of a servo or some mechanism to deploy the chute. We have different methods. The chute will deploy. The G-force is probably less than 6G load when it deploys. And we have a descent rate of 1,360 feet per minute from 1,000 feet. So what you want to do is you take into account the mass of the air vehicle and make sure that when it lands that it doesn't damage the air vehicle. And then we have some options. There's some things you can do to the parachute to reduce oscillation as it's coming down. And then we also have an auto cutter mechanism, because if you come down in a windy environment, and even though the air vehicle's on the ground, the wind could still blow the parachute and drag the air vehicle around the ground. So there's actually a mechanism that when it hits the ground, it has an auto cutter mechanism that cuts the cords away from the chute. So
that's clever. Yeah,
it's pretty interesting. Yeah, they have, I'd say, systems from the small UAS, you know, say Aerosonde, Scan Eagle size, up to 200 kilogram kind of air vehicle. But maybe on these quadcopters, they should come up with something maybe a little lower budget in that size. The challenge is, even on, say, a 20-kilogram UAV, the package is about a half a pound that you'd be carrying. You know, weight's very critical. So
that was my question. What's the loss in weight? You know, you're adding to these only have so much lift. You're adding to the weight to it. So it's a compromise. Do you want to compromise the weight and make sure you keep your camera? Or so for something the size of a Scan Eagle, what kind of cost are we talking about?
Yeah, it's what is the volume? A little over a liter volume and package. Like I said, about a half a pound in weight and cost in the $1,500 range.
So if for Scan Eagle, you're talking about a multi-million dollar aircraft, $1,500 to save it is cheap change to protect what you're going to lose.
Yeah, and that would be, like I say, any of these SUAS that fit into this, what's the FAA, less than 55 pounds or something, you know, right. the smaller
UAVs. Yeah.
Yep, you know, the Aerosonde, Scan Eagle, the Arcturus, you know, all those smaller ones. The Ravens and Pumas, they just land, I think they just skid on the ground from what I've seen in videos and things, so... those types of UAVs probably wouldn't need it. But, yeah, some of the larger ones with the more expensive payloads and more expensive asset is where it makes sense. But then again, you got a weight component, and these things are always pushing the weight limit. They don't want to reduce endurance, and you add weight, you're going to reduce endurance. And depending on what kind of air vehicle it is, you might add a half a pound, and you have to add another half a pound to balance the CG. So that's the challenge.
Sure.
You're talking motors, you're talking recovery. What's on the horizon for you and as far as the technology goes?
I think some of the unknowns on the propulsion side are what are some of the redundancy features we're going to need to add in the future for the civilian airspace stuff. We're getting some indications on some of the redundancies some of our customers would like to see, but just like a Continental or Lycoming engine, there's when they started switching to fuel injected type systems, how redundant do you need to be? Do you need to have dual fuel pumps and dual ECUs and dual injectors? And it gets crazy, especially when you're talking some of these smaller propulsion systems, you're going to easily double the weight. So then that's really not feasible. So I think we're doing a lot of work in that area, trying to understand what the requirements are, trying to, I guess on a lot of our systems, the EFI systems, we try to use as much high volume validated hardware as we can. The orbital air DI technologies, you know, on over 800,000 consumer products. So the base components and technology and control systems and all that stuff are validated. It's not some guy in his garage that's got two engines running and thinks they have a solution. So that's the big thing, is what do you really need to do to get the reliability that is going to keep the customer happy, keep the air vehicle reliably in the air, especially as these guys are charging for camera time, and also meet the FAA requirements in the future.
Well, Bob, maybe you can tell our listeners where they can learn more about UAV Propulsion Tech.
Yeah, just go to UAVpropulsiontech.com. There's information on all the companies I spoke about, technical information, videos on some of the UAVs that are using this technology. And my contact details are on there. If they have any questions, they can email me or give me a call.
All right, great. David, what do you think?
I think this has been fantastic. Bob, I really appreciate you coming on and reaching out to us, and hopefully maybe you'll come back and talk some more, because I'm sure that as Max and I have learned over the last 18 episodes, from when we started, things have changed. So I'm sure 6 months from now or a year, things will be completely different, and we'll still be talking about the FAA roadmap, I'm sure.
So, yeah, that sounds good. Yeah, I appreciate you having me on. It's a great opportunity. I'm happy about all the work you guys are doing to promote this business, and thanks again.
Well, thank you. So you've been listening to episode 18 of the UAV Digest. You can find show notes at theuavdigest.com, or you can use the shortcut, which is theuavdigest.com/18 for episode 18. David, where else can they find us?
Our social media presence, of course, is on Twitter. It's at UAV Digest. On Facebook, it's UAV Digest. And don't forget, you can always provide us feedback. And the email address for that is feedback@theuavdigest.com. And if you love us, leave us a comment on iTunes or Stitcher.com, so where we stream you directly to your mobile phone. So that about wraps it up for this week. We'll see you in 7 days. So this has been David in Philly.
And Max in Hartford.
Thanks for listening.